Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, hello, hello. It is another wonderful rainy Tuesday evening in Western New York. And I'm Patty, and this is The Bone Collector. So, as promised, we're going to talk about the tragic history of Willard Asylum. But I did a little teaser on my Facebook, if you guys follow These Old Bones on Facebook. You'll find little teasers and information. Soon we're going to start playing little games so you guys can win prizes on my podcast. And we're going to be in the next few weeks adding video to the podcast too, so we can share photos of what we're talking about. And then also... you can see me, so you know who the Bone Collector is. I have with me my trusty little Fred, who is exploring the office and seeing if there's anything new from last week. I can guarantee you there is not. But he seems to think that there are things that sit on our ceiling, sit in the corners, and mock him. So every so often he'll make a little noise because he's feeling a little... picked on by something that we cannot see. So, like I said, there was a little bit of a teaser of a cryptid event that happened today, 90 years ago, May 2nd, 1933. I just want to see, give you guys a second to take a little bit of give a guess. Do 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 do. All right. So, if you guys guessed, it was the first sighting, official sighting, and reported sighting of the Loch Ness Monster. You are correct. If you said anything else, you're wrong. So, 90 years ago today was the first official sighting of the Loch Ness Monster. And according to the History Channel, amateur investigators have kept a vigil along the shores of Loch Ness to see if they can get a glimpse of this creature. 1960s, there was some expeditions done by some British universities, and they did some sonar in the lake, and surprise, surprise, just like any dead show, Bigfoot show, ghost show, anything that you watch on TV, there was no conclusive evidence that either validates or debunks the existence of Loch Ness. However, they said that in each of the expeditions, some type of large moving object had been detected. So we don't know what it could have been. They couldn't figure it out. But in 1975, they did an expedition combined with sonar and underwater photography, and after enhancing the photo, and I'm going to enhance in air quotes, it appeared that there was something captured that vaguely resembled a giant flipper of an aquatic animal. Now, some believe that the Loch Ness Monster is a dinosaur that's been trapped in the loch for thousands of years. Some people believe that it is a large eel-like animal. We don't know. There's never been a corpse. I find it hard to believe that there's only that for it to be a dinosaur, that it has lived thousands of years in a landlocked body of water by itself and has no way to produce or evidence that it's produced offspring that it can mate, because there's only one of them. So it's one of those, I'm not going to say that it does or doesn't exist. How about that? We'll leave that up to the scientists and anybody else that has some kind of idea, more of an idea of what it is. Now, I did find some interesting paranormal news from Paranormal Underground, the April 2023 issue, which you can get on their website, on the Paranormal Underground website. You can get a digital subscription sent right to your mailbox for $19.99 a year. I love the magazine. It covers anything and everything that's paranormal, even crystals and different kinds of metaphysical things as well. It's not just ghosts and goblins and creatures and stuff. Now, the little bit of information that I found, it's a two-part monster that was seen in the Philippines. And it says that in February, residents of Talisay City called the police and reported seeing a fearsome mythical creature known as the Manananggal. So it's kind of like the song that one of my friends sent me, Manamana, but a lot more letters than that. This creature is known mostly from the Philippines folklore, and it says to be a bat-like creature that can separate its body at the torso. Authorities actually held a press conference about the sightings to calm local residents. It's pretty interesting that it can separate itself from its body. And the image that they have, the drawing that goes along with the article in the magazine, is actually bat wings on a humanoid body, but the waist, from the waist down, is missing, and it's just like blood and a spine coming out of it. It's just kind of weird the way that they illustrate some of this stuff. And then there's a glowing green ghoul in Scotland. The Scotia Bar, which claims to be the oldest pub in Glasgow, is said to house many ghosts, including a former manager who hanged himself in the cellar and a prostitute named Annie. Paranormal investigators were there on March 5th, and they went to the pub in hopes of capturing some evidence of ghostly activity, and they believe they got lucky when one of their team members named Anthony snapped a photo that seems to show a smiling green face. They're going to revisit the pub and see if they can make contact with more spirits. So good luck to, what is the name? Let's see. Good luck to, I got to get the name of the group here because I didn't quite catch that. Paranormal Supernatural. Paranormal Supernatural Investigations Ireland. So good luck to them, and hopefully they can find some evidence of who may be in the pub. All right. So that's our paranormal news and our little tidbit of in history today, which I got right into my mailbox from the History Channel. Kind of caught my eye going, oh, what a wonderful day to have something paranormal in my mailbox. So now we're going to go on to Willard. And I'm going to start the Willard discussion with a little bit of background on the mental illness at the time and a little bit earlier. This is a sensitive subject, so just going to say that, like many historians, we do incorporate, depending on the text, some of the language that they used then. So just for you all to not say, oh my God, I can't believe she said that word. It's for historic context only. Those are words that I do not use myself. All right, so let's start this off with the care of the mentally ill were at one time the responsibility of the family and their community. In the 19th century, the names that were used to describe them were often demeaning and cruel, and society tolerated people with mental illness, but they also believed that they had nothing of any value to offer to society. And before the 1800s, mental illnesses were looked at as more of a curse, and in some cases an affliction cast upon that person by the devil himself, especially in a time where church had the upper, they were the ones who kind of ruled the daily life instead of the government or the monarchs. The church had supreme control, and they would strike fear into the minds of the poor and uneducated, because that's, you know, they believed that, and in most cases, the people in their congregation were not educated. They could not read. They could not write. The church was looked upon as who told them what was right and what was wrong and what they should and shouldn't do, and that what the church said was law. So they would tell their congregations that any deviation from God's laws or the church's laws would bring down horrible types of punishment on them and their families, including mental illness. They drilled it into their minds that mental illness was a punishment. So an example would be that a woman who had a child out of wedlock and then had the child was born with mental illness would be told that God had punished the woman for her transgression by giving her a child that, in air quotes, would have been an idiot. Like I said, there was no political correctness at that time, and for historical context, you know, I hate using those words, but we are going to need to in some cases. Families often hid those relatives away from their neighbors as best that they could so they wouldn't be judged because of it being seen as a punishment, because they didn't want their neighbors to think that they had done something wrong. It was especially true in small villages and remote communities, and in the rural areas, the insane were targets of witch hunts, automatically blamed for various crimes and unexplained events. Therefore, instead of getting help that they desperately needed, they would often be imprisoned and tortured. So if anything tragic would happen, you know, it's more like liking it to the witch trials, when something would happen to your neighbor, and they couldn't figure out why. Like the cow went dry. Now this wouldn't be in with the mental illness, but your cow stopped producing milk. You must have been cursed by your neighbor and she must be a witch. That kind of thing. Things that would disappear, animals that would disappear. You could say anything about your neighbor who had a mental illness, even cover up your own crime that you have done and blame it on somebody with a mental illness. And they would tend to believe, no matter how good the family was and how good of heart that person had, if a neighbor said that it was because of their mental illness, they could get away with anything. Advances in medicine toward the end of the 19th century would shed a lot more light on the disorders and diseases of the brain. And then they began to try to develop courses of treatment, which would be horrifically painful and sometimes responsible for the death of the patient. And they were no better off with the treatment than they would have been without. The scientists who made significant breakthroughs in psychology and psychotherapy didn't come onto the scene until the 20th century. And until these medical pioneers, you know, took an interest in medical, into the mental illness and how, what it actually was, there were some people that advocated for their humane treatment. Now, the whole with New York State and the reason why these institutions were opened began in 1824 when the New York State legislature passed a law that required every county across the state of New York to open up a poorhouse that would support those who couldn't take care of themselves and would otherwise have been a burden to society. And the services of the county homes were not limited to taking care of the poor and destitute citizens, but they were also to be open to the community's lunatic citizens as well. And while the mentally ill were figured into the equation when the law was written, they did not have an idea of the extent of the problem of mental illness at the time, nor did they have an idea of how to take care of those with mental illnesses and the poorhouses. So they would just be put in with the general population. 16 years after the first poorhouse opened in the state, so many people suffering from mental illnesses would turn to the county for help that the state had no choice but to open a hospital dedicated to those cases. And with that, the New York State Asylum at Utica opened in 1843, and that opening was followed up by several private institutions that were to care for the mentally ill. And although the Utica Asylum was equipped to handle the majority of the cases, there were limitations on what care was provided. Only acute cases were admitted, and if the patients were not cured within 2 years, they were remanded back to the custody of their county home as a lost cause. Now, we know that in the early 1800s, there wasn't a whole lot that they offered as far as treatment for the mentally ill. So really, they went to the Utica Asylum for 2 years, and as we know, without being properly medicated, now the majority of the mental illnesses were incurable. They're incurable now. We just treat them, and people are able to handle them and to live with them. So those that were deemed incurable or chronically insane by their physician at home wouldn't even be taken to the asylum. So it really, the Utica Asylum offered nothing to the mentally ill. And most families couldn't afford the small fortune to have them put into a private institution. So they remained in the care of the poorhouse, which then again put all the pressure and all of the weight of those with the mental illnesses to be put into a general population that in some cases, as we know, some of the mental illnesses have them do horrible, horrible acts, and you're in these poorhouses with women and children who are often, they can't protect themselves. So then you've got the whole other problem. And in the meantime, the state asylum quickly filled the capacity and became overcrowded. So the protocols carefully set into getting the treatment of the patients were disregarded. they had such a workload on them that whole, you know, 2 years, if one, you know, they would keep them for up to 2 years and then they would be put back into the poorhouses. And they were just most of the patients, once they got overcrowded, were discharged before the 2 years were up. And it didn't matter what the progress of their recovery was, because they needed to get the new patients in that needed help as well. And it was a system that was bound to break down, and it broke down a lot quicker than they thought. So they just, and I go back to the dilemma that the poorhouses faced was that they couldn't handle any type of mentally ill resident, especially those that had conditions that were chronic or deemed incurable. And the physicians at the poorhouses generally had their own practices in addition to doing the duties at home, that the doctors had made regular rounds to see the residents at the poorhouses. It was just once a month unless there was an emergency. And even then they were limited. They had limited education in regards to mental diseases. So in general, everyday care was routinely maintained by the stewards and the matrons, who were just like hospital orderlies today. And it was not any stretch of imagination that the treatment of the insane was less than stellar. And with an example of Rolling Hills Asylum, which is the Genesee County poorhouse, it was often reported that those with mental diseases were chained and shackled to the floors and the walls in windowless basements, outhouses, sheds, in their rooms with just straw on the floor and no beds. They were just treated horrifically. Now, Sylvester Willard, for what the Willard Asylum was named after, was a physician in Albany. And he became appalled at the mental health system in New York State. And in the 1860s, he played an important role in reforming the treatment of the mentally ill. And he came from a long line of humanitarians, religious leaders, and doctors. So Dr. Willard took it as his duty to serve his fellow man very seriously. And this was summed up in an excerpt from his obituary in 1864, that he possessed a large executive ability and power to readily bringing other minds into harmony with his own. His moral qualities were akin to his intellectual one. He had great simplicity and directness of character. With him, the question, what is right, was all-absorbing, and he sought to settle it by light from above and within. And he oversaw the investigation into each poorhouse in New York State, how those with mental diseases were cared for. And it was much worse than what he had thought. Cleanliness was not enforced. The mentally ill residents were covered in their own filth. Many slept on loose straw spread directly on the hard floor, and the straw was wet with urine and feces, not unlike the pens of housed livestock in a barn, and it appeared they had not been changed in days or even weeks. There was inadequate ventilation, which meant that there was little to no fresh air, and some of the residents were kept in dark, cramped cells or cages, often with no shoes or clothing, which became extremely unbearable in the winter months. He took his findings to the New York State Legislature to campaign for the change, and 6 days before he died in 1864, the New York State Legislature passed a law that called for a new state asylum, which would be named after him, which would be the Willard Asylum for the Insane in Ovid, New York. And then we get into now just dive deep into the Willard Asylum. It started off as a small facility with one building that was to house 250 patients. And it was in the old Agricultural College building on the eastern shore of Seneca Lake. And it was a great location because it was open landscape and farmland, and it would provide hope for those who would that had become hopeless. The very first patients at the asylum arrived at the Ovid Landing on a steamboat on October 12, 1869. Her name was Mary Roach. She was a 28-year-old woman from Columbia County, and she had been a resident at her county poorhouse for more than a decade. Now, the records don't show what the exact nature was of her mental illness. However, the treatment she received and her physical appearance when she arrived at the dock could show how her life had been for the past decade. She spent 10 years of her life chained to the wall in her room at the poorhouse. She reportedly had no bed or clothing, and when she got off the boat, she was so physically deformed that her atrophied muscles made it almost impossible for her to walk. And she came with three other people, but I'm going to get more into how the records were kept. Even though this was supposed to be a more humane way of taking care of the patients at Willard, the people with mental illnesses at Willard, they really weren't treated much better than at the poorhouses. In fact, records show that they weren't even listed in the books by their name, but more of by a number. So even though she came with three other men to Ovid Landing, she was registered as patient number one in the book at Willard. So she was the very first. And the men that came with her were bound in irons and chains. And it says that one of the men was confined to a box that resembled a chicken crate that was no more than 3.5 feet square. So this man was crammed into a box that was 3.5 feet by 3.5 feet by 3.5 feet. And it looked like a chicken coop. This is at first the main objective in Dr. Willard's vision was to transition the patients from the horrific treatment that they got at the county poorhouses to a more compassionate care that they would be given at the asylum, because the definition of asylum is a place of retreat and security, a sanctuary. And each new patient, they got bathed, they got clothes, they got fed, and that was, to them, was something that was very foreign. They had no occupational skills, but the asylum was designed to make them more self-sufficient. So they taught who they could teach some tangible skills, and they were put to work, just like in the poorhouses. The people that lived in the poorhouses did not just stay there and the county paid for them to be there. They actually had to work. They were forced to work, whether it was farming, in the kitchen, doing the laundry for everybody in the poorhouses. So if these people that came to the Willard Asylum were able to do any kind of manual labor, they were put to work, and they would report that it was more like slave labor, long hours and harsh working conditions. Though they couldn't substantiate any of these claims, you know, how else did things get done when you had so many patients and so little staff, and the whole entire place was even with state funding, should have been self-sufficient because they had a farm on the property and everything like that. Those who were unable to work were given activities to do, like doing puzzles and crafts to occupy their time, so nobody would just be put into their room and left to sit all day. And, they tried to make it appear to be as hunky-dory and all rainbows and stuff, and we're going to help all of these people that are mentally ill, that have been forgotten and didn't receive the help that they need, and we're going to give it to them. And behind that facade, it was just dark and it was horrific. It was often said that a trip to Willard was a one-way ticket to a living hell, especially during its first 75 years in existence, and that for most people, the only way that they've left Willard was in a plain pine box. And it says that, in fact, statistics were nearly half of the 58,000 patients that were treated at Willard Asylum died at Willard Asylum. And the causes of those deaths were not always attributed to their illnesses, their mental illnesses. They weren't like cancers and things like that, that you would expect them to pass away in such a facility. Most of the deaths were attributed to the inhumane and experimental treatments that they got there. And we'll never know any of the truth because the death records were either incomplete, missing, or sealed by the state, depending on how long ago it was. And if you could actually decipher what the names were of the inmates, seeing that they were only known as numbers. And the stigma that the family believed was attached for them to having a family member having a mental illness led them to just abandon them on the doorsteps of the asylum. But the funny thing was, is as you got into closer to the end of the 19th century and then the Victorian times, there were just such a wide range of reasons that you could be admitted into Willard Asylum. And some of them were just absolutely absurd. You had intemperance, masturbation, inbreeding, desertion by their husband. Oh my God, your husband left you. You must be insane. Let's take you to the asylum. You read a novel. It was that time of your life, a woman who was going through the change. Oh my God, she must have a mental illness. Superstition, grief, and laziness. And most of the time, family was just trying to avoid an embarrassment for what was minor illnesses or behavioral problems instead of trying to fix the behavioral problems or what problems within the family. They would just drop them off at Willard saying, oh, they must be insane. There's something wrong with them. And they would drop them off at Willard and most of them wouldn't see their families again. And even after they died, the patients remained alone because even after their death, their families didn't come and claim their remains. And during the 19th century, the government found this neglect as a way to further medical research. And Willard and other state-run institutions were required by law to turn over any unclaimed bodies to a medical school to be used as research cadavers. So not only were these people treated inhumanely, and they were abandoned by their family for God knows the million reasons why, no matter how stupid they were dropped off there, forgotten, never saw their family again, died there, and then were disrespected and turned into research cadavers. said after that law was discontinued, the bodies of the deceased were buried in the Willard Cemetery, and there they would remain anonymous and forgotten, only to be known by an obscure number. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Willard Cemetery. Willard Cemetery is a pretty dark but peaceful place. In that cemetery, there are so many people that are buried there with no idea who they are. And I have that to get forward to a little bit more. The people that worked at the asylum, and I'm not going to say all of them, but a good portion of them, didn't treat the people there that lived there very well. But you would find some of the people that, some of the patients took it upon themselves to make that up and to try to make it right for their fellow inmates, as they were called. And there was one man that would make his life work to see that they were given the respect that they deserved in death that they had not received in life. And his name was Lawrence Mocha. And he was born in 1878 in Austria, and his parents were poor. And he had to find work, and he learned the trade of metal working so that he could earn a decent wage. And in 1905, he did metal working until he was 27 years old, and he had a severe head injury after he was struck in the head with a rock. And the side effect to that injury, along with brain damage, was alcoholism. And the excessive drinking led to loud and exciting singing and whistling, which led him to be committed into an asylum in Dusseldorf, Germany. And 2 years later, he was released, and he made his way over to the United States. He entered the United States through the port of New York City, and he found employment as a window washer at Bellevue Hospital. And we all know that Bellevue had a reputation of housing mental patients. And he was in desperate need to fit in with his new surroundings. He wanted to fit in with American citizens, and he would take night classes to learn English. This job that he had at Bellevue would bring him into an asylum as a patient for the second time in his life. It would be the last. He would never come out of an asylum alive. He had one of his spells in 1916, and spell in air quotes, that he began singing loudly and energetically while praying, and he just claimed to hear God speaking to him. Now, he was religious. He was thankful for the life that he had. Unlike going to church, I mean, it's the same as going to church and people singing loudly and praising God. However, the behavior that he had on that day, they put him in the psych ward, and he continued to insist that he heard the voice of God and he saw angels. And at the age of 40, he was brought from Bellevue to Willard. In the first couple of years that he was at Willard, he stayed for him, kind of to himself, but he wanted to desperately find something to make himself feel productive. So he wanted to work outside doing something like ground maintenance, in which transitioned him into what would be his most notable occupation there at the asylum as a resident, was that he would dig graves. And he began to dig perfect burial plots by hand for the deceased. he knew that he was not insane. However, there was no one there that would advocate for them, for the those mentally ill patients there. So he took it upon himself to write a letter to the superintendent of Willard asking for his release. And it says, Dr. Kyle, I hereby, Lawrence Mocha, stop work. Yesterday afternoon, I asked you, doctor, to discharge me from a Willard asylum. I am capable to do my living independently. I want also to get money for my work here. I make over 8 years, more than 500 graves myself, another heavy work all year round. I asked doctor to prepare my trunk, which I brought here from Central Islip. It is my own, and I bought it in Dusseldorf. I am respectfully yours. The answer that he got to this letter was, you're not leaving the asylum. And for 23 more years, he dug the graves for the patients that died there. And he didn't get paid either. In 1868, at 90, he died and was buried among the rest of the patients there. And the groundskeeper, Gunther Mings, said that Lawrence had, he dug until he died. And during his 50 years at Willard Asylum, Lawrence Mocha dug more than 1,500 graves. And he tirelessly worked to give the deceased the dignity and burial they deserved and would not get from the hospital. And it is the same that he did not get in return either. So the respect that he put onto the patients and to help what he thought would be helping their souls rest in peace, he did not get himself. And he just got a stake with a number on it. And then in 2015, there was a group of people that were working to give some of the deceased at Willard some recognition that they had been there. And they were able to erect a monument, a small little memorial inside the cemetery at his burial plot, or as far as they could tell was at his burial plot. And it says, Lawrence Mocha, June 23rd, 1878 to October 26th, 1968. He died 1968, not 1868. As I said before, I misspoke. The grave digger. In his half century as a Willard patient, Lawrence dug over 1,500 graves for his fellow patients who are buried in this cemetery, that they might find a final resting place long after the world had forgotten them. Now, Willard Cemetery sits on a hill, and right on the shore of Seneca Lake on the east side. So the cemetery overlooks the lake, and the view is actually absolutely beautiful. But you wouldn't know that there was a cemetery there, because the only indication there is a cemetery in the clearing comes from the sign that sits on the road at the bottom of the hill leading to it that reads Willard Cemetery. The cemetery was used from 1870 to 2000. Here laid to rest are 5,776 departed Willard residents. Now, in the northwest corner, under a canopy of a hardwood tree, there are the graves of 38 Civil War veterans that are marked and decorated with American flags. And each of those veterans served in the Grand Army of the Republic, but they were also patients of Willard Asylum. They are all marked. The southwest corner has a fenced-in area with a simple arch that reads the old Jewish cemetery, and placed in front of the arch is a stone that says, in remembrance of the Jewish residents buried at Willard Psychiatric Center, 1870 to 1992. That is semi-marked. The rest of the meadow holds the remains of thousands of people who died over a 130-year time period. And each grave had been originally marked with either a wooden stake or a little metal disc that had their patient number on it. And the metal discs were made at the asylum and the metal foundry. But over time, the wood would rot away. And with time and the changes in the landscape and the upheaval and the in the winter months and the thawing and the wet of the summer months, the metal discs with their number on it sank into the ground and grass grew over them. And to a stranger who would just walk up there, it would be just a beautiful, quiet meadow. But those who visited there and know the story know that there's so much more lying under that ground. Now, my son and I have visited there several times. There are people who've put memorials out way, way, way out into the meadow in the southeast section is a solar lantern on a little hook, and it sits there, and it has a cross, a handmade cross of sticks and twine to mark the grave of somebody. We also were able to, we wanted to uncover Mary Roat's disc with number one on it. We were able to find the smallest number that we could find on there was patient number three. We could not find the disc for patients number two or number one, who would be Mary Roat. Number two, number three, number four came with her on that first day. Not everybody who died at Willard was buried there. People that passed the first few years were placed in a unmarked cemetery behind Grandview, which is its main building. And then the patients, there's Patients Row in the Ovid Union Cemetery and an unmarked grave in Holy Cross Cemetery. Now, in May of 2016, Holy Cross Cemetery dedicated a granite memorial with the names of all 268 Willard patients that are buried there. So it's really hard to explain just how much weight this all is on people now who know that they were, these patients were not treated right, and they're not going to ever be given the recognition that they were alive. That's the thing, is by only being known as a number and those records are gone, it essentially has wiped these people's existence off of the face of the earth. Now, 1995, New York State shut down Willard. There was not enough patients there to keep it open. So they took those patients and they transferred them to other nursing homes and facilities. And I actually got to meet some of the people that were involved in that transferring of patients. And they told me that they had gotten so attached to these people, and they were sweet people that were patients there, that they cried after they took them to their new homes because they knew they would not see them again. And as the last patients were discharged, the staff had to go from building to building and take an inventory of what was there. And a couple of the workers had thought that they finished when they found a door to the attic that they hadn't noticed before. And when they opened the door, they saw shelves that were filled with suitcases and boxes. And there was an energy in the room. Beverly Cartwright, who was one of the people who discovered it, that moment she opened the door, it was like they were tied to the people that had passed away there were tied to the few remaining treasures that didn't find their way home. The attic had contained 427 suitcases that were placed on shelves in alphabetical order and separated by gender. And each of these were tagged with the owner's name and patient number. And they belonged to people that came there from 1910 to 1960. And each of these suitcases, they contained bits and pieces of their personal life, things that were important to them that they thought they would need on this trip to Willard, not knowing beforehand that they would never be leaving. There were records, sewing notions, travel souvenirs, family photographs and letters, figurines, books, and personal care items. And the suitcases were supposed to be there until their owners left the asylum. However, as I've said many, many times, no one left Willard. No one left there. And that when the patients passed away, the family didn't come and collect their bodies, they definitely were not going to come and collect their belongings and their suitcases. But the staff who developed these relationships with the parent, with these patients in the later years of Willard, they didn't have the heart to throw those belongings away, so they just left them on the shelf. And as time went on and the nurses came and went and orderlies came and went, it was just simply forgotten that those suitcases were there until they were found in 1995. And I'm going to tell you that there were two people that I'm going to tell you the story of their suitcase really quick. First one was Margaret. Margaret was a tuberculosis nurse, and because she treated patients with TB, she contracted it, and she was forcibly admitted to Willard only because she annoyed people. I do get that. She annoyed people. So she came to Willard in 1941, and she felt like a fly trapped in a spider web, and she stayed there for 32 years until she died. And what she brought with her was 18 suitcases and boxes that contained her entire life. And after she died, her family left her and her life behind. They didn't claim her body, and her belongings sat there from 1941 until 1995 in that attic unclaimed. Dimitri and his wife came to the United States. He's the other one that I wanted to talk about. In 1949, they came from the Ukraine, and they were kept in Nazi work camps during World War II. When they came to America, they settled in a community in Syracuse that was a large Ukrainian neighborhood. And Sophia, his wife, was pregnant, and she suffered a miscarriage and died. And Dimitri just lost his mind. He became absolutely delusional. He started to have fantasies of being married to Truman's daughter, Margaret. And in 1952, he took a trip to Washington, D.C., and knocked on the door of the White House asking to see his wife. He was quickly arrested by the Secret Service, and he was placed in a mental institution where a year later he was transferred to Willard. Dimitri was a model patient and a prolific artist, and a lot of his paintings are in local galleries and museums. And he was one of the few who was able to leave Willard. He was placed in a county home where he died in the year 2000, but his suitcase and all his belongings were still there. Now, there is a book. Let me find the title of it. Oh, my, it is a phenomenal book that talks about the lives of the suitcases. Let me see if I can find it. I have it in here. Of course, all of my books are not all books. Okay, all books in my... It is called The Lives They Left Behind. And the Lives They Left Behind, Suitcases from a State Hospital Attic. And it's by Darby Penny and Peter Statsny. So I would recommend that you read this, to even just borrow it. It just goes through and it has, talks about Willard and how the people pulled up, how they saw Willard when they got there and their impressions of it. And they take pictures of the suitcases of some of these residents. And they dig into their lives. They talk a lot about Lawrence and what was in his suitcase. He had a shaving black knob handled shaving brush, and the bristles were yellowish and brittle. And he had heavy white elastic suspenders with button attachments. And it just talks about the suitcase was brown leather handle metal clasp closure. He had one pair of black men's black leather dress shoes, 3-button closure flap. He had a shaving mug with a white bottom stamped in green print, Chester Hotel, China. So it goes through and it also talks about a mental health exam and some questions. It just, the few residents that it was able to, patients it was able to go through and talk about is just amazing, because it was a place that people went to, and rarely, I want to say they, you can say that they never come out, because they really don't come out. And to me, it's a place that we need to keep the history going, show what these patients went through. Like I said, I go there quite often, probably at least once a year, just to drive around the grounds. The buildings are falling in. The state is not taking care of any of them. But then to be able to go up to the cemetery and walk around and just feel the sorrow and try to reflect on what the patients went through that are buried there. You walk up the hill to that cemetery and you just see vastness. And that vast openness really drives it home that in that empty space is over nearly 5,800 people are buried in that empty space. And all it is just a field. And most of that is not even mowed. So it's high grass. There's a small tree line that has some metal stakes with numbers on it they made at the foundry. But it's weird because the numbers are duplicated in that where they're not in the ground, they're leaning up against trees and stuff, and they're duplicated. So I'm not quite sure how you would have two patients with the same number, but if you have a chance to go check it out. But this was horrific, terrible history of the Willard Asylum. We have a great show for next week. I've already got planned every number off the top of my head, but you guys are going to love it next Tuesday, 8 o'clock. Thank you for joining me tonight as I rambled on about Willard.